When I was looking at the Robert Graves poem, this is partly he bases this on something called the Orphic Gold Tablets, and these are little incantations or spells that the Orphic initiate, when they're buried, have buried with them, and because they remind, it's like a talisman to remind the Orphic initiate that when they enter into the underworld, not to drink of the spring of forgetfulness, but to go to the spring of memory where the great serpent is, and that will lead you into the presence of Persephone, who is the mistress of the underworld, and in this poetic way phrase, the spokeless wheel. And so the figure, in a way, that Parmenides encounters in his vision is Persephone, is the underworld, the dark mother, is another form of the dark Madonna in some ways. Now, there's a whole tradition, which we haven't got time to get into at all, really, but there's a way of looking at the Iliad and the Odyssey as a description of this particular path of Greek shamanism. Because the phrase that is used in the Parmenides poem is the man who knows, which means the one who has mitis. Now, mitis is a particular kind of quality of consciousness that in the Odyssey is exemplified by Odysseus. And one of the things you find in the Parmenides poem is this interplay between appearance and truth and illusion. Empedocles talks about this as the difference between the goddess of enchantment, Aphrodite, and the goddess he calls Mad Strife, which is Persephone. And while you might think that a goddess of love is, and love is the place to go, Empedocles says, I go with Strife, I go with Persephone, I go into the dark. Because in Aphrodite is seen as the energy that entangles us in delusion, that ties us into things that we shouldn't be tied into. Now, the Iliad is all about the experience of going further and further into delusion. Because when the Iliad is all, there is a choice at the beginning of the Iliad that Paris makes about which is the greatest goddess. And he has a choice between Athena, who is the goddess of wisdom, Hera, who is the queen of heaven, and Aphrodite, who is the mistress of love and enchantment. And of course he chooses Aphrodite. And everything else that follows from that is the consequences of choosing delusion. And there's a marvelous bit in the Iliad where Odysseus, who's a man who isn't caught in this, there's a moment where the Greeks are about to go away and stop the war and not get caught up in it, and Odysseus drives them back into the deluded place because they haven't yet learned the lessons they need to learn from delusion. And so what you see, and you get this whole, so if you read the Iliad, it's one delusion after another, one madness after another, Achilles sulking in his tent, and what we're shown over and over again, and of course the thing that we're shown at the end is the ultimate delusion of the Trojan horse, so deception. We're shown time and time again of deception and tricking, and how as human beings we trick ourselves up. And the final book of the Iliad is the burial games of Patrocles, and what you're shown there is a whole practice of returning to the beginning. So what you have is the charioteer who wins the race is taught how to be a charioteer for this race by Mentor. It's where we get the name Mentor from. Mentor is the wise man of the Achaeans, and he says to him that what you have to do is, when you are heading out, when your energies are moving out, there is a point, there is a post set up in ancient times, so long ago that no one knows why it is set up. But if you, but and that's the place where the chariot path returns to the beginning, and if you sight yourself at that point and flip around it, you will be faster than all the others and return to the beginning faster than them. Now, without going into all the many details of the Iliad and the Odyssey, the Odyssey ends with having Odysseus, if the journey of the Iliad is a journey into delusion, and the, in a sense, that chariot game, which is the funeral games, represents the death of illusion, and we're shown a method of freeing ourselves and returning back to the beginning. The Odyssey is all about the journey home, that journey home in detail, and looks about how, and what you see is Odysseus disentangling himself from situation after situation. And where the Odyssey ends is not in him coming home. He does all that, takes possession of his home. He then has to take a ship's oar and take it into the midmost of the land, to a place where they will not know that it is an oar, because they have not seen the sea, but plant it in the land, and they in fact will think it's a winnowing fan to winnow chaff from the proper wheat, and you plant that there, and it will be a sign for a new generation. Now that planted oar is the same as the post that is planted that everybody's forgotten about in the Patroclean games. So there's a whole, and so in a way that whole shamanic tradition that Parmenides and Empedocles talk about is shown in detail in the Iliad and the Odyssey. And in particular in the Odyssey, there's an amazing bit about the descent into the underworld, where we're shown the practice of the descent into the underworld, because there's a whole process of giving blood to the dead, which isn't literal. It means reversing the attention into the underworld in the way we do when we bring our senses in and move inwards in that way. And what happens to Odysseus as he does this? One of his friends has recently died, and so they're the first person he encounters. And then there's a whole process of like descending through the underworld and meeting family ghosts, meeting older friends who've died, then meeting his parents, then meeting his ancestors, and then increasingly he starts to meet the ancient dead of Greece. So he meets these great cultural kind of figures, and where he finally comes to is Heracles, who is the oak hero, who is the immortalized human being, who can be both in the underworld and on Mount Olympus, and therefore who is the axis of the universe. And so what we see in the Odyssey is a clear description of the practice of incubation and all the levels that we encounter, which is kind of the thing that we're doing. We explore the world so like this. We're going through our personal life into collective life, into layers of collective life. So it's all there really in the Odyssey and the Iliad. And the other brilliant thing about this, you have to stop me because I can talk about this endlessly, but the other brilliant thing is, this is the journey of Odysseus, right? But the journey of Penelope. Penelope sleeps on this, does her own incubation in this extraordinary bed, that this amazing olive tree that is also the axis of the universe. And what Penelope does is to weave and unweave Odysseus's burial shroud each day. And she is, of course, constantly dealing in her own place with the suitors who are trying to dispossess her of her property. So although it's a dual journey. It's Odysseus's journey and Penelope's journey. Okay, anybody else with anything we want before I just sum up? Anything else that, any detail that needs tying up?
Yeah. Ask about the priests for a moment. It's all right with the Eucharist.
Yeah.
So with the Roman Catholic lot, they believe the transubstance, some bread and the wine become actual bread and wine of Christ's body.
Mm-hmm.
The Protestants don't believe that this is a symbolic thing. What about the priest himself or herself these days? Aren't they needing to be a pure vessel to allow that?
No. No. In Catholic, in both cases, the priest is seen as the intermediary, so the spiritual state of the priest is irrelevant.
Oh, good.
Right, so a priest can be a terrible sinner, and still give the Eucharist. So the priestly ordination is seen as having nothing to do with the inner state of the priest, really.
I think there's a really interesting thing here about actually happening and literally happening, because it actually happens, but that is the mystery, because obviously it doesn't literally happen, because you're left with the wafer and wine, thank God.
Yes, that's right.
From disgusting. So, you know, people think actual means literal, don't they? But that is what the mystery is, isn't it?
No, that's the mystery, and they talk about the mystery of transubstantiation. And the mystery of faith involved in that is the belief that you are receiving Christ into your body and blood. You know, so that's it.
I like what you said about the priest doesn't have to be pure. What it reminds me about is the magician. And, you know, so, okay, I can let the energy come through because I don't have to... I can be a sinner.
Yeah,
and
that's right. Yeah.
Still allow that to come through. So it's something about, because the magician so helps me to connect with whatever the energy is that comes in.
No, definitely.
And it's me, because it's not about me.
No, exactly. And it is just that stance that allows the energy to come through you, however you are. It doesn't matter. It's not your energy. It's the energy that comes through you completely. Yeah. Mm.
Something interesting did come up in our breakout room about connecting to the wider world and about the personal feelings of distress or grief or anger that one might encounter going out in that way into the world. I wondered if you had anything to say about that.
Okay. What do you mean?
You might whiz across to a war zone and suddenly feel... personally incredibly emotional about it.
Yes, well, you were then just like everything else, you were just the thing about the creation of Grail Space, it's a corporate act, so you're holding it, you're not on your own, you're with your, so the thing that, actually this is actually quite important really, the thing about the creation of this particular form of Grail Space, it's not you creating the container. In some exercises, we create the container. The container is created between. It's as your light touches the light, even of the objects in your room, and that is reflected back to you. It's that that creates the container. And then any reaction, so the container is not your personal container. So by the time you're reaching out to a war zone, you've kind of embraced the world, or much of the world. So it's that sense of together holding something very big. And then your own feelings, your own reactions are just part of what is being held. So it's not wrong to have them, let them be there, but again they just need offering up into that wider field of holding. You know, and obviously one of the things that if you're doing it at that level, one of the things I particularly would suggest reaching out to for help is the four archangels and asking them to hold with you, you know, because they were very good at doing that. I think what can happen sometimes...
Interesting discussion we had between the four of us. It was. I wasn't sure we were getting any further, so I thought I'd ask what you thought.
Well, one of the problems that can happen if we overstretch ourselves, we're not reaching, if we're trying to do too much ourselves in that sense and not leaning back enough into that kind of field of holding, is we can kind of just, that container can break and we get overwhelmed by our own grief or anger or views. And then we're not able to be in grail space, then we're somewhere else. The whole point about grail space is the creation of a container of clarity and kindness that holds really whatever disturbance is being touched into and is big enough to hold that so that some of those energies can be digested and kind of unmoved a little. And if the container isn't big enough, and if the holding isn't big enough, then it doesn't. Then it sort of breaks down. It doesn't really work. But it's why, I mean, creating grail space is a bit like exercising a muscle, right? So you do it. So it's very important to do it in just quite small ways, so that you get a sense, in particular, of say, if I'm doing it with my cup, right? So if me and my cat, so I'm noticing my cup in a certain sense is responding to my attention, and we're creating this gestalt of Ian in the cup. So the cup is infused with a sense of me, I'm infused with that sense of cupness. And so there's that sense of something happening between us, there's me in the cup. If I add to that the chair that I'm sitting in, I'm adding then not just the sense of cupness, but the sense of support, the sense of my chair holding me. And so if you like, the quality of the vessel starts to enlarge a little bit. If I look across the room to the table with an image of a goddess on it, and I include that, that's a larger thing that starts to come in. So the container becomes kind of larger. Or if I reach out to the archangels, then because I'm very used to doing that, the container then becomes very big and very, very strong and kind of, and then the capacity to hold becomes enormous. But it's kind of important to practice it in all kinds of small kind of ways. So doing grail space with a cup, with a TV remote, things that you wouldn't think about doing it with. Is actually because actually you then discover, if you do it with a TV remote, one of the things that starts to come in is a sense of speed and quickness and control. So things have unexpected qualities. And one of the issues we have sometimes is we can get very stereotyped. You know, I always reach out to the archangels, and that's very, I do. But also, if I reach out to my remote, this will give me some qualities that I won't find in the archangels in quite the same way. So it's like an intuitive practice creating grail space. And the more unusual the objects you do it with, the more you'll discover about our capacity to generate that space.
The remote generates, because I was thinking the moon works really well for me, and the remote generates a different conversation, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does, completely.
Dialogues, meeting in a different way.
Yeah, totally.
Then you can meet in all sorts of ways rather than just the moon, which is easy.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, exactly. That's exactly the point, Rob. Well put. Right, you're expanding your capacity to reach out and relate in that way by experimenting and trying things out.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose really that my distress about the war situation, as an example,
yeah,
is that it's about letting it go and sacrificing it, letting it go to the angels, or you know, so that that can also be held in the bundle.
That can happen as well, yeah, totally, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, completely.
Well, it's letting it be held, isn't it, really, because...
Yeah.
They're normal reactions which won't go away, but it's letting it be held in a greater sphere so that it's not at the forefront of your...
Yeah.
It's not getting in the way.
Not getting in the way, or at the very least, where you feel held in it, so you're not on your own in it, you're not lost in it on your own, so you remember there is goodness in the universe, there is holding in the universe. Okay, so I just want to spend a couple of minutes just summarising quite quickly what we've done today, because actually what we've done is quite simple in this weekend. We've gone back to the beginning. We're continuing with this work of working with the House of Life and working with the middle pillar and exercises. So, and what we're working with there really is the waking up of the creative energy, the waking up of the serpent power, little by little. What we've done in terms of the relationship to working with the myths is we've gone right back to the beginning before. So we've gone right back in a sense to the Ice Ages, to the and in a certain sense the point of doing this is to set a particular ground and approach. So we're not looking for a pure Welsh myth, because there's no such thing. What we are looking at is the way in which myths and mythical images transmigrate across the world and are in constant kind of conversation. Now, one of the things that we find is when we go right back to the very beginning places, to the ring and cup marks, to the shaman of Paviland, is what we find is this profoundly interconnected universe, which, as Phil said, really parallels the quantum physics and the sort of quantum physics understanding. So in a very curious and this paradoxical way, going back to the beginning brings us right up to date, right into the center of things. And similarly, the practice of Grail space is a practical application of that. And includes both that sense that we get from the shaman of Paviland and that sense of profound quantum entanglement, where each element of the universe is entangled with every other. Now, what we're going to do in the 3 years is to move slowly through the different layers of myth. What we've also done is looked a little at the beginnings of the Inklings work. Now the meditation that we did that was based upon the Swan Ship links to the very beginnings of Tolkien's work. Stories called The History of Middle-earth. That is, with Tolkien, you have the Silmarillion, you have The Hobbit, and the Lord of the Rings, which are his main published works. But you also have the 12 volumes of The History of Middle-earth, which were the collection of all his writings about Middle-earth. And from his very earliest writings is about the journey of Elfwyn, whose name means elf friend, across the sea to a magical island, to the cottage of dreams, which then takes him into a deeper journey to the blessed lands of the West. And that meditation was all about that journey. So what we've done in meditation is linked in really with the beginnings of Tolkien's work. And then we looked a little at to the Tolkien's writings about In a Hole There Was a Hobbit. We looked at him in the First World War and the way in which that will have contributed. We also looked at Charles Williams, and a little less at C.S. Lewis, again looking at their beginnings and looking at what they contributed and why they contributed what they did. Now, subsequent weekends, we're going to look. Next time, we'll likely be looking more at the Romano-British level of the Arthurian myth, and starting to explore the structure of Tolkien's myth a little more, really. But the important, truly important bit about this weekend's work is this sense of profound interconnectedness. Revisit the Paviland shaman and touch into that very, very ancient tradition. Keep practicing with the House of Life, and again notice how as we work with the House of Life, the imagery reflects some of the strata that we're looking at. So one of the things that happened this weekend was the sword that appeared. It was an old bronze age sword.
Yeah.
Very ancient sword. And the Pavilion Shaman appears as one of the images of in the Book of Yesod. So these are the things. So what we expect to happen, because the House of Life is like a magic mirror that reflects what we're reflecting into. So as we explore these strata, when you work with the House of Life in your own way, you will find echoes of the symbolism that we're exploring within your own House of Life. I do recommend Charles Williams's book, The War in Heaven. I recommend all his books, actually, but The War in Heaven is probably the one that's most directly related to what we're looking at. And depending on how you like to read things, you could either, it's a great read in its own right, very cheaply available on Kindle. But also, if you like audiobooks, it's a very good listen, really. And it has, and obviously, we're talking about a book written the early part of the 20th century, so it has got that very particular literary style associated with it. So that can make it a bit slightly inaccessible at first, but once you get used to it, there's a lot of really interesting material in that book in particular. And a lot of very powerful traditions to do with the nature of the Grail. Because one of the great things about that book is they're all fighting over the possession of this chalice, and the priest King John, in fact, tells the Duke of the West Riding, who's a Catholic who wants the chalice for his own greater Grail cult, tells him of course that he loves the thing much more than the master of the Grail, and tells him off for that, because the whole point about the Grail is not a thing. And yet this whole book is about people fighting over possession of the thing. It's also notable, this book, for having its description of evil, and the three levels of the Klipot are described most clearly in this book. There's a character called Gregory Persimmons, who's the publisher, who's a wicked publisher, who represents that sense of chata, or the reactivity and lost in his own reactivity. And then there's a figure called Manasseh, who's a Kabbalist who desires to destroy everything, and that represents the level of Klipa called Peshar. And then there is a Greek who is completely nihilistic and is devoted to unmaking for the sake of unmaking, and he represents the layer of the Klipot that's called Avon. So there's a very profound, there's lots of profound meditations in that book, so it's really worth listening to or read.
Yeah, could I say, it's the PDF is free at Project Gutenberg.
Oh, great, good. So that's good, yeah.
That's easy to read.
Easily found in that case. Yeah, good. Yeah, his books are out of copyright, so they're, that's where they're easily found. A little tip, however, though, if you are interested in the audiobook, if you buy the Kindle version, and the Kindle versions are really cheap, you get the audiobook really cheap. Over Amazon.
It's also on Spotify, if you've got a Spotify
account. Oh, is it? Oh, well, great, you've got a Spotify account. You can get it there, great, good. Cool. Okay, so is there anything else before we finish that's on people's minds before we go into the final meditation?
It's raining.
I know. It actually just stopped here. It has been raining. It's just stopped in Glastonbury for a moment anyway.
Stopped in Cardiff and the sun's come out, so that's good.
That's good, Rob. I'm glad to hear then. I suppose going back to the Ephern and Parmenides, probably if you want to learn about Parmenides, it probably is that Dark Places of Wisdom probably is the best book, easiest book to choose. Most of the other books are very heavy academic books, and they're good, but you'd have to be quite, whereas that book is accessible, and the stuff he says, it's slightly irritating writing style, but it is pretty good, really.
I read it once, and then I just felt I needed to read it again. And all the other books are about £100, whereas that one is much cheaper.
God, are they?
Yeah, Reality is like really expensive now, and the other one you mentioned, really expensive.
Oh, really? Oh, God. Right, well, don't get the expensive one, because they're not worth it enough, really. They can't have. And what can be worth it, if you're interested in it, is just get a reasonable translation of the Odyssey and the Iliad, and if you read it with that point of view, it becomes quite clear what's going on there. If you understand the Iliad as being about the process of delusion and getting caught up in delusion, and in the Odyssey about freeing ourselves from delusion, it's there's an awful lot in that, really. Okay, let's just sit together while I thank the archangels, and then we can draw our time to a close. Just coming back to your bodies, coming back to this fundamental practice of just being aware and just locating ourselves in space. Just letting ourselves notice the effect of the weekend upon us. And then consciously just dropping that, letting it all just rest within the structure of the body, letting our body digest it, knowing that our process will just take us through whatever we need to take, wherever we need to move through in order for it to be digested. Auriel, we thank you. Go in peace. Gabriel, we thank you. Go in peace. Mikael, we thank you. Go in peace. Raphael, we thank you. Go in peace. May we all go in peace. Thank you very much.